Welcome to Life as a Patient Doctor. I'm your host, Stephanie Moss, navigating life as a patient and a future MD. Walk alongside me as I reflect on the challenges and lessons I've learned undergoing medical school with invisible disabilities. Join me as I interview other doctors, students, and healthcare workers on their own journeys. Listen to their unique stories on how they have balanced their health while caring for others in the health profession. Hello, everyone. Today, I'll be picking off from my previous episode regarding my own personal health journey as both a patient getting diagnosed during my medical school career. So I'm going to pick off talking about right before I got to medical school. I'm going to talk about now what happened when I got into medical school and how learning about these different conditions started getting me to realize that I might also suffer from health conditions myself and actually going through to try to get diagnosed. So I'm reading following from the Endo Foundation, the article that I wrote back in 2021, which is The Connection Between Pelvic Pain and Childhood Trauma. A medical student tells her story. And if you haven't seen the first part, I recommend you go back a couple of podcast episodes where I talked about growing up with pelvic pain and talked about medical gaslighting and why I didn't get diagnosed for many years and went through all my teenage years, college, a lot of my pre-med without getting diagnosed. So today I'll be kind of going forward and talking about what happened when I actually got into medical school. And specifically, it was my second year of medical school that a lot of these symptoms started becoming more salient and I started going back to trying to get a diagnosis. I put on the writing, the privilege of being a medical student. And it really was a privilege because in medical school, at least for my medical school that I went to, they give us a health insurance as part of our plan. Eventually you could opt in or opt out. Originally, when I first went to medical school, everyone got it and it was a Blue Cross Blue Shield. It is a Blue Cross Blue Shield PPO plan. So it's really like the Cadillac health insurance that a lot of specialties are covered both in the hospital and wherever. A lot of places have like a lot of the surgeries covered, medications. The copay is relatively low, but I kind of used that as an opportunity to really catch up on my own healthcare because previously I was on my parents' plan and my dad works for the government in Colorado. We got Kaiser, which is an HMO plan. So I could only see the specialists in their plan. And if I went to a specialist that didn't provide me with a lot of information or couldn't diagnose me, that was it. I didn't really have a lot of movement or autonomy to go to a different hospital or go to a different clinic. It also wasn't my plan. I was still under 26 at that point. And if you're outside the US, in the US, you can only stay on your parents' plan up until you're 26 years old. And so I think when I went into medical school, I had I was about to turn 26. So I already knew I had to get my own insurance. And I was really thankful that my medical school provided us with health insurance and a really good one. I could either go to the university to get healthcare or look it up on my own. So as I said, I really got to go to top-notch physicians. And because I had my own health insurance, I really felt like I had more autonomy, seek out physicians if I didn't like a certain physician or I wanted to kind of go outside, I could. I'm in Chicago, so there's a lot of health programs. There's a lot of doctors, a lot of specialists. So I was really lucky in that sense. But let's go back. I haven't gotten there quite yet. So first year medical school, I was just surviving. I was just getting through academics, and then COVID hit in March. We went virtual, had a couple months off for summer, and then we started off my second year of medical school, still virtual, on the sex and reproductive block. So the second year really is where things started happening. So in this block, we started learning about all the different types of reproductive health conditions for both female bodies and male bodies. And I really like that entire block was really a blur. We have this textbook called First Aid, which I don't think I have out right now because I haven't used it in a long time. There's a lot. It pretty much goes through like every single major health, pretty much every single health condition, and then has like a little paragraph regarding the key things of that health condition, like symptoms, pathology, and then how to treat it, how to search for it, if you need to do surgery, if there's medications, just a general overview. And that's what we use during the first and second years of medical school to just learn all the health conditions. And I remember when I started learning about a lot of these health conditions, I just started reading things that I started realizing that things that I thought were normal were actually not normal and were considered a symptom or a health problems. For example, like pain in general. I had grown up pretty much a lot of my life thinking that pain was normal, and it's not. Specifically regarding like menstruation and going to the bathroom, all these different things, I thought it was normal to have pain. And as I started reading these health conditions, as I started answering questions on my quizzes and tests, instead of really focusing on what the question stem is and really separating myself between being a human being and really a patient, and then being a doctor or a medical student, that's where the lines started to really blur. And I started really freaking out because every single practice question or even question on the exam or quiz, I started thinking about myself and almost using the question stand as a way to self-diagnose. Up to this point, I didn't have a diagnosis myself. So I was freaking out and kind of seeing myself in every single problem. And so I ended up going to one of the primary care doctors that was assigned to us as medical students. And I told them like, hey, I've been dealing with these symptoms. I didn't really know they were a problem until I started learning about them in class. And this is really where I suffered the first time with, well, I had, if you look before, I had medical gaslighting before, but this was kind of a different level. And specifically, this doctor was like, oh no, you're just a medical student. Medical students always come to me and say they have this condition because they're reading about it. And I want to pause for a second and say, like, yes, when you're reading about health conditions and learning about stuff and finding a lot of information, it can be scary. And you can start seeing, like, for example, if you have a little dot on your skin and like you're learning about skin cancer. Yes, it's possible that you start freaking out that you have skin cancer, but it doesn't last. You don't spend all your energy into thinking about it. And already, because I had undiagnosed anxiety, I was already freaking out about. I want to take note that, like, yes, there are students that this can happen to, that you start freaking out, you see it in your own health condition. But that doesn't mean that your feelings and your thoughts aren't valid. And it doesn't mean that anyone has the right to say you are crazy or what you're feeling is wrong or not true. That's not fair. And a better way that a health practitioner or professional or doctor can say is like, well, why do you feel that way? Okay, well, you say this. Well, actually, that, like, even though you might feel this experience from the science, this is what we say. And then actually look into it, maybe look at the little mole and be like, oh, I understand how maybe you'd be concerned because it has different color. But see that it has a hair? most likely not cancer. Or look, it hasn't changed size. Or not, for example, not this, but I'm just saying, using that as an education to help someone feel better, but then also educate them, like, yes, your feelings and fear is valid, but, and then help them calm down and then teach them why they don't need to be scared. Versus in this example, this doctor specifically was really dismissive. And it's really sad that that was my experience. And especially for female health conditions, it's not uncommon. It's actually fairly common that individuals go through multiple doctors and multiple years of being misdiagnosed or ignored. And this is a problem in our health profession that we're starting to notice and starting to address. We've talked about in medical school, we're talking about at conferences, we're talking about it, and we're also developing in our school, in our curriculum, learning about how to diagnose individuals earlier and how we can not just ignore them or push them to the side. Going back, that was a bit of a rabbit hole, but I really hope if you're a future health professional, that experience gives you something to realize if you're feeling scared that you might have a health condition. Yes, it's possible that maybe you don't have it, but those emotions and feelings are valid that you're scared. And so seeking out someone who can help you through those emotions, whether that's a therapist or actually going to a doctor and confirming, like, no, you're fine because of this reason. Or let's do this test if it's not too expensive and make sure you don't have it. So going back, it was sad that going to the doctors and just saying, oh, it's a medical student brain, or, oh, it's your anxiety. That's really sad, because I could notice as a future doctor, this is why there's so many health disparities and why some patients have distrust, especially females of color. I'm Latina, and individuals of color, there's a lot of racism and a lot of different kind of really sexism for female health conditions, where in the past a lot, and unfortunately a lot of people ignore females who are in pain. And that is something, like I said, is one of my passions to try and combat. And there's a lot of other healthcare workers and doctors and professionals that are really working to combat that and teach, like, no, we should look into this. And even if we can't find the reason right now, there are ways that we can support individuals. But thinking back to being a second year medical student, and it was hard because I really did become a little obsessed with trying to figure out what type of health condition I had. And this obsession and fear and anxiety ended up really impacting me negatively, because even though I feel like I was learning a lot of information because I was studying all these different conditions, I wasn't studying to learn. I was learning to try to self-diagnose, and that's something we shouldn't do, because there's a lot of bias in my own experience. And that's why we say that we can't diagnose our friends and our family members, because that bias can lead us to different paths. And like I said, it really impacted my academics, and the fact that I had failed the exam, the final, I didn't fail the first exam, but the final exam of the entire block, I failed. And that was my first failure for a course. And I was so upset. I was very scared because I didn't know what would happen. I didn't know if they would kick me out of medical school because I failed my second year exam. And thankfully, all what happened is I got to retake it, and then I passed and kept going. And I feel like that's like a side note of a lot of students get very scared when they fail. And for whatever reason, thankfully, you do get another chance usually. Even on a big board exam, which I talk about in other podcast episodes, if you fail an exam, it doesn't mean you're a failure yourself. It means there's some reason, whether if it's not knowing knowledge, stress, anxiety. In this example, I was doing a lot of self-diagnosis during each question. And it's really important to not give up. Because I remember in that instant when I first thought I failed, that's where imposter syndrome really came in, that I thought I wasn't cut out for medicine. And I'm so glad that I was able to push through, that I had a supportive partner who was also in medical school with me. And he was like, no, you can do this. And I was able to retake the exam, more just focus on the questions, separate myself and be like, okay, I'm going to go to a different doctor and we'll figure out what to do over here. And then right now I'm a medical student and I'm just going to look at the question and answer the question of the diagnosis for this specific 4 to 5 sentence paragraph of this patient. They are not me. This is the question. And this was, I guess, actually realizing this was the very first time that I started learning how to be a patient doctor. Of there are some instances as that they can come together and they can balance and strengthen each other. But there is also importance of knowing how to separate yourself and being like, this is me. I'm a human. I have pains. I have health conditions. But it's not going to impact my judgment of this job I have as a doctor to diagnose this other patient. So this was really, I'm realizing the first time that I really learned how to do that personal separation. And this was in my second year of medical school. I was just reading about patients. I wasn't even treating, like, being in front of a physical patient yet. And it's really cool looking back now as a fourth year medical student about to go to residency. It's really cool to see how I've individually have grown from this experience to learning how to be this duality of a patient and a doctor. So going back to what I did next. So once I was able to really separate myself, and this time is really focusing on my symptoms. So I said, sometimes I did have the opportunity to meet with an OB-GYN who specialized in gynecological pain conditions. Through this research phase, I ended up finding a OB-GYN who specialized in specific pelvic pain and abdominal pain conditions, and they were not a part of my university. I actually went outside. Now, like I said, I had this cat-like plan, so I had the opportunity to go outside, and I remember I was so nervous and I was so scared, like, will she believe me this time? And am I really just a medical student freaking out? And I remember being in the room and so scared, you know, not sitting in the doctor chair, sitting in the patient chair. I remember I had the opportunity to either sit on the exam table or sit in a chair. And I was so scared to sit on the exam table. So I was like, I'm going to sit right here in the chair. Which now as a doctor, I have so much appreciation and recognition of how helpful it is to have the patient sit dressed in a chair and talk to them like that and not sit on the table naked in a gown. I've learned throughout going to my OB-GYN rotation and family med, like, it's really helpful if you can see the patient first, it's helping them feel safe. And then once we've talked about everything, then leaving the room, allowing them to change if they feel comfortable on the exam table and walking them through. But we'll get to that in a bit. So sitting there, I had my list. I remember I had my list on my phone of these different questions, all the symptoms I had experienced since I was in high school or even younger, since middle school. I wrote down the list and I remember the doctor came in and I was able to go through all the symptoms and the most amazing thing happened. She believed me. She said, wow, you've been through a lot. So sorry you've had that pain and you've been through all that time, but it does sound like you have a condition, which she thought was endometriosis. And she's like, let's get you scheduled for a surgery. The very next month, in 1 month, after 10 years of going to doctors, going to the hospital, going to the emergency room, going as a medical student to a doctor, and them saying, no, you're just having anxiety. A doctor who was specialized in this, who was able to do that separation and realize these are the symptoms. And you're right, I am concerned. And let's do the next steps to see if that is true. And I remember feeling so empowered that someone listened to me and they believed me. And looking at it from a trauma perspective, having someone believe in you is huge and very comforting, because a lot of individuals who have had trauma, and it doesn't matter the type of trauma, even this medical gaslighting and being ignored and discredited by the healthcare can be a trauma. And feeling secure in the experience that you're experiencing or the emotions is very validating and help form that physician-patient relationship. And so in a couple of weeks, I think it was during Thanksgiving of COVID, I went in to a surgery, and it was funny. I chose that specific doctor since she was specifically trained in endometriosis and specifically trained for minimally invasive surgery using the Da Vinci machine, which back in 2020, there were very few Da Vinci machines in the entire city of Chicago, and my university medical school happened to be one of the few hospitals that actually had the Da Vinci machine to actually go in very minimally invasive to go in. And this specific doctor put dye that you can actually see where there is more blood flow. Using that information, she would then go through and cut out the areas that were receiving the most blood, because most likely that could be cells of endometriosis. And I remember saying, this was my very first like actual surgery under anesthesia in my own medical school. And I was a second year medical student. And I remember even sitting there, and I was so excited to finally go through my surgery, but then also terrified because I didn't know what to expect. And I remember, I think it was either a third or a fourth year medical student came in. I think it was a third year medical student. And they were like, oh, wow, you're still awake. I thought you would be asleep. We chatted for a bit and she asked permission if she could join the surgery. And I actually let her join the surgery. So she got to actually watch the Da Vinci machine go in. After that, I didn't, even though that was a good experience, nothing that happened, but I did learn later on for the future that I didn't want my own, like any students from my own school to be present, because it's very awkward to, especially in these types of things, to have your co-students and classmates. So now I tell them, like, especially when I'm in my own hospital or clinic, I'm like, please no medical students. However, once I'm a resident, that probably will change. I'll be more okay with having medical students come and take care of me, because being a medical student myself, it's so important to have that learning experience. But there is a boundary that is important. And to have that for myself of saying like, hey, I'm not comfortable with this. And so right now, let's not do this. And that was a important boundary and lesson I got to learn. So the surgery went well. I remember being in like the pre-op room. They put you in my place. They have this like bear hugger, like big purple, big poofy thing that like heats up and makes you very comfortable and warm. And the anesthesiologist came in and gave me the medication to help me calm down. And that's pretty much all I remember, because that's probably when They put in the thing that would help me not remember things. And so the only thing I remember is waking up. And was it this one? Yeah. This wake up was horrendous. I was in so much pain. I think I even woke up from the surgery, from the pain in post-op, not under the knife. And that's all I could think about is pain. And the post-op nurse came and was like, do you want some more painkiller? And I'm like, yes. I think she IV'd it. And it wasn't hitting. And it was just so, so painful. I think I asked her for more, like 2 or 3 times. And that is also a big lesson, is like to communicate, like, I'm not feeling good. This was like 10 out of 10 pain that was just not going away. And the nurse came up to me at some point and she was like, before you leave, before we bring your husband back, you have to stand up, walk over there and try to pee. And I was like, yeah, no, that is not happening. I can't even move. I am so weak. But eventually we did walk and I was able to pee. And then my husband came back, but oh my God, I literally almost fainted from the pain. And eventually they let my husband back. I'm a medical student, type A, like if you read before, black belt. So I had this black belt energy of I can do everything myself. But this surgery really challenged me because I remember them saying, asking if I felt strong enough to be able to walk to the car. And normally I would be like, yeah, of course I can walk. And I remember like almost trying and I'm like, if I move a single step, I'm going to faint from the pain. And so I accepted the wheelchair. Another big lesson is learning your limits, learning when to say no and being like, I can't do this. I need help. So I fought my own strong-willedness and I was like, yes, wheelchair. And the surgeon at some point came and asked me like if I wanted to learn like what happened. And I was like, I couldn't even think. So much pain, so much just nausea. My stomach was huge and painful. And she told my husband everything needed to know. I don't even remember when that happened, really. And oh my goodness, the drive home was horrible. I remember my husband said he drove super slow, super carefully, but I feel like every crack in the street and bump and turn, like it was so painful. Since then, I remember from later on when I did my IVF type procedures and learn about pains, I learned to have a type of pillow around the seatbelt. So helpful. And let me think back. Okay, so I remember going to sleep and then waking up the next morning and being like, okay, I need to find out like what happened. Now that I have more of a clear head, like what happened? What did they find? My husband was able to show me pictures from the Da Vinci, which was really cool. And I have them actually, I think I even posted them online so you can go see them to see what it looks like to do that Da Vinci. What does like the ovaries look like and what does uterus and what could like this green fluorescent look like? It can look different. That's the big thing about endometriosis. Every single endometriosis patient can be different because what endometriosis means is there are cells, little tiny cells that are similar to the uterus, the endometrium in the abdomen, anywhere. It can be on the colon. It can be on the liver. Sometimes it actually even, they found endometriosis cells in the lungs. So like it can really go anywhere and not just one area. Some people have ovarian cysts called chocolate cysts. So like huge, big, not like the cysts that I mentioned in the first episode, but like huge cysts where the cells, because the endometrium in the uterus have different hormones. It bleeds. And if you think about that, blood needs to go somewhere. Normally in the uterus, it comes out in menstruation in a period. But if that little cell is sitting on top of the ovary and it bleeds, it's just going to bleed into the abdomen. So it forms like this little cyst protection, and that's what can cause pain. Same thing if it's on peritoneum, which means the walls of the abdomen. It bleeds into the abdomen, and our abdomen's not supposed to be filled with blood fluid, especially over years and years and years. And that's how like scar tissue can form. So little things like this, and that's what the surgeon looked for. And so I didn't have the endometriomas. However, she did see a like scar. She saw scars and like something that she called a defect, which can mean like, which could, not necessarily, it could also be there since I was born, but most likely she has seen as a surgeon that sometimes the cells can land on the wall. And then as the body starts saying like, hey, you're not supposed to be bleeding, kind of eats itself. And then that's where that hole can form. And so I had a hole in my peritoneum between my uterus and my large intestine. And so that's where possibly like as blood, as that area was bleeding, that's where like a lot of my pain could be. And it could even have gone on to my intestines. So in the end, there's a lot of different ways that endometriosis can show up. The gold standard and what they require is the surgery to actually go in and see it and take tissue to send it to pathology. And an additional little thing that my doctor did that I didn't even think of up to this point is actually look at my fallopian tubes. She did a procedure that I'm really glad she did, because normally people do it later on in a different procedure, but she, because she's a specialist, she learned to just, sometimes it's better to do it together all at once. The surgeon puts his fluid into the fallopian tubes, and you can see on an image to see how far, like it goes through the vagina, through the cervix, through the uterus, and it's supposed to go up and out of the fallopian tubes. And the fallopian tubes, if you didn't know, they're open. Yeah, open. And the ovary's not really connected. And so that fluid's supposed to go, if this was fallopian tube, fluid's supposed to go up, 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 and go out to spread out into the abdomen. And you'll see, like, you're supposed to see, like, this fluid on both sides come out. What she found in my situation is that the fluid went up, or, like, barely went up, which means that both my fallopian tubes were clogged. And that's, again, another sign of endometriosis, that little endometrial cells are in there. And every time they bleed or something, the body is like, you're not supposed to be doing that. So go in and scar up the area, try to heal it. Scarring is a healing mechanism to try to clean it up. But by doing that, it clogs my fallopian tubes. And I do want to say, at this point, I'm a second year medical student. Like, I didn't even think about this. I didn't even know about this procedure until actually third year medical school. When my husband walked through what the surgeon said, that fluid didn't come out of my fallopian tubes, I remember like freezing and dissociating and being like, oh my God, this means I can't have kids naturally. And it's funny because I wasn't even thinking about having kids, especially at this point. I was a medical student. My husband and I were focusing on medical school. We were going to focus on residency and then think about kids post-residency. The second he told me that the doctor had found that my fallopian tubes were clogged, I realized that I was, in some sense, infertile. And it's interesting because I kind of went through things backwards. Usually people struggle to conceive and have kids, and then get worked up for infertility. And then they can find that their fallopian tubes are clogged. And then they can find out they have infections or endometriosis or other reasons. I kind of went backwards. I, another time, freaked out because I realized, oh my God, I have lost that ability to choose when and if I'm going to get pregnant, at least in my mind. And that started this whole process of figuring out, like, okay, I need to freeze my eggs. Okay, we need to freeze embryos. Okay, we need to do that because I don't know if my endometriosis will get worse. And then I really cannot have kids, even with IVF. You can look at my other podcast episodes that I wrote about, and you can see on my website, medpsychmoss.com, where I really write and share more about the IVF, the infertility, the freezing of my eggs, of my embryos, and going through that process. So I won't go into that now. This episode is really just to share my experience really from the very beginning of being diagnosed. And I want to just share that experience and how this experience of having a health condition, having disabilities, really will help me be a better doctor and help me connect with my patients, because I've been there. I've received that news. I've had that pain. It really also motivated me on my personal advocacy journey, encouraging other healthcare workers, doctors, and providers to talk to their patients about their pain, being empathetic, especially like even if it doesn't seem like they have a health condition, like it's important to at least humor it, or at least explain, like, yes, your feelings are valid, but these are the reasons why I'm not concerned. Or these are the steps we need to take in order to confirm you don't have that health condition or don't have something. And it's important to talk to patients and show kind of that empathetic lens, especially when someone's in emotional or physical pain, because it is a traumatic experience and it is a trauma on the body and the pain to constantly be ignored or just not believed. And I think that's where I'll finish off this episode. So thank you so much for listening in to this episode on my own personal journey as a medical student with health conditions and being diagnosed. I really hope this helps other people, whether they are healthcare students themselves or just have these health conditions or just need some motivation on how to talk to their doctor. I really hope this helps. And just remember, you are not alone in this experience. I know how lonely it can feel to be in pain and to be ignored. And I want to tell you, you're not alone, and don't give up. Your feelings and your pain is valid. You can get through this. I hope that my journey and my experience can be of help to you. If it was, please share it with someone else. Please share it so we can spread this news on how to see healthcare workers and people as human, to bring the humanity into medicine. If you have similar pelvic pain or sexual health or reproductive health conditions, or even infertility, I've created my blog posts and resources on my website, medpsychmoss.com, with resources that I have used and I hope will help you, and also resources that I've acquired and keep learning from other patients, from other healthcare providers. They're all on my website, book podcasts, books, videos, anything that I found that was helpful, research papers. I hope that helps you from a patient side. And then also from a health provider side, I have another section of resources, how you can best support different individuals with pelvic pain, with infertility, and just have more of a, I like to call it a trauma-informed approach, that recognizing that trauma does exist and how you can better take care of others in the sense of being trauma-informed and taking care of their mental health. That way you can be a better healthcare worker, professional, provider, and doctor. I also have a social media at MedPsychMoss on all the social media accounts, so please follow me there. And of course, if you're listening to the podcast, subscribe and follow so you can listen to the other ones. I also share not just my own journey, but other patients in the health profession that are both patients and healthcare workers or doctors themselves. So I hope you take value of this experience, and I look forward to seeing you next time. Take care.